Okay, so yesterday we started on the four factors of stream entry. The first one being Saporisa Sangsewa, association with good people, superior persons. And we'll begin on the next second. The second factor for stream entry, hearing the true Dhamma, Saddhamma Sawana, is central to realization. The canon describes numerous occasions when people, whether lay or monastic, attain stream entry through hearing the teachings. The following is an excellent example in that it comes after the Buddha gives a graduated discourse, which was a common way. We mentioned it. The other day, that the Anupubhikatha, which is the a graduated discourse, graduated teaching to introduce people to the teachings and then to enter, be a and usually culminated in the Buddha teaching the Four Noble Truths, and people make having a realization of a stream entry. These are rather stock phrases in the Pali and appear many times through the canon, but this one in particular is the first time they appear in the Sutta Pitaka. So it's from Digha Nikaya, Sutta number 3, I forgot to look up what Digha 3 was. Anyways, Digha 3, what, I forgot what the name of the sutta is. Pokhara Sati? Yeah, it must have been Pokhara Sati Sutta. Because it, as soon as I looked down, it's sort of, okay, and as Pokhara Sati sat there. So, Pokhara Sati So, and as Pokhara Sati sat there, the Lord delivered a graduated discourse on generosity, on morality, and on heaven, showing the danger, degradation, and corruption of sense desires and the profit of renunciation. And when the Lord knew that Pokhara Sati's mind was ready, pliable, free from the hindrances, joyful and calm, then he preached a sermon on Dhamma in brief, on suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. And just as a clean cloth from which all stains have been removed receives the dye perfectly, so in the Brahman Pokhara Sati, as he sat there arose the pure and spotless Dhamma eye, and he knew whatever things have an origin must come to cessation. And Pokhara Sati, having seen, attained, experienced, and penetrated the Dhamma, having passed beyond doubt, transcended uncertainty, having gained perfect confidence in the teacher's doctrine without relying on others, said, "Excellent, Lord, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who had got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place, so that those with eyes could see what was there. Just so the Blessed One has expounded the Dhamma in various ways. I go with my son, my wife, my ministers and counselors for refuge to the Reverend Gotama, to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha. May the Reverend Gotama accept me as a lay follower who has taken refuge from this day forth as long as life shall last." So that's a one of course the, that sense of hearing, yeah, hearing the true Dhamma and or hearing the good teachings, and the Buddha, and as I mentioned the other day of how the Buddha would prepare the person's mind, understanding, helping to stabilize and settle the person in what was skillful, and so generosity, on sila, on heaven, the sense of there are, say, higher realms of existence, and then showing the drawback of sense desires, sensuality, the sense realm, the world of the senses, and then the fruits of renunciation of that which. And that when the Lord knew the Pukrasati's mind was ready, and these are qualities of mind that say the mind is ready, is alert, it's alert, it's steady, it's pliable. That's one of the qualities, not just of the mind ready to receive the Dhamma, being pliable, the muttu is in the Pali, and it's malleable, pliable. It's also that's also one of the descriptions of the mind with samadhi, that the mind becomes malleable, pliable. It's not rigid, it's not fixed.
So the word mutable.
Yes, mutable.
I think mutable is probably related.
Related to that in English. free from the hindrances. So again, the importance of working with the hindrances, being able to clear the mind from these fundamental hindrances overwhelm awareness and diminish our wisdom, discernment. But also joyful and calm, to really penetrate the Dhamma, you can't be agitated and miserable. That's not a good standard, or not a good foundation for understanding the teachings. Any comments, additions, questions? Yeah.
There's a question on the true Dharma in these conversations that I've been having about what are the sources, and the sources are the sutta, yeah? Sutta, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But it's kind of the classic text, and there's a lot of resources available, books, etc.
Yes.
Which expound Dharma as well.
Yeah.
Would you have any guidance on that as we're studying?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think certainly that which has a foundation in generosity and virtue and kamma. So right, I mean, there's some basic foundations of right view, that there are the fruits of actions, there is the results of actions. That's a good standard. That which is inclining to relinquishment, that has laid a solid foundation in compassion and a willingness to be not bound up with self. So all of those are qualities that are a good standard of, is that, do they align with what are the fundamental teachings that the Buddha himself praised?
I'm just wondering if my question was more what sources study?
Oh, sources?
For Sadhamma, the true Dhamma.
Oh dear. I mean, there's lots and lots contemporary teachers. I mean, you have to of course, the greatest source is the Buddha himself. our own kind of tradition is grounded in the, say, like Ajahn Chah and Lumpa Samedo and the other forest traditions. But, you know, even, you know, even in a contemporary sense, all of the teachers, you know, draw on many different sources, and a lot of it is having that kind of discernment as to what lines up with the principles that are, you know. I mean, it's kind of like what comes to mind is when Ajahn Chah was in America, and Paul Breiter, a former monk, wore Banyo. He had left the robes a couple years before that and had been in America studying mostly Zen at that point, but also, you know, different teachings and you know, getting exposed to all sorts of. He went to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, so he's exposed to all sorts of teachings and then him talking with Lumpa Cha and saying, you know, that his you know, he had a friend of his who wasn't so keen on formal meditation or formal practice, but it, you know, he was really keen on you know, putting it into, as a, like, sports and rock climbing. He felt completely alive and present and in the present moment, and so. Paul asking Ajahn Chah, "Well, can this be practiced as well?" And Lumpa sort of, I mean, he burst out laughing. And said, you know, only a Farang would think that climbing rocks is going to be a way to enlightenment. But then he said, you know, is he contemplating the Four Noble Truths when he's climbing rocks?" So, you know, it's a really good standard of what's the mind inclining to, you know, whatever we're doing, you know, whether we're reading or studying or listening to different teachings. Does it help us incline to the, you know, dukkha and the ending of dukkha?
Yeah, I'd say one of the, there's so much material around and about these days, and oftentimes, particularly on the web, you get quotations like, you know, the Buddha said, and it's good to check, well, did he? Because often there's tags are on there, but it's kind of a dubious translation, or not even a translation, it's just sort of a copy of a copy of a copy of someone's right idea. So that, in a way, applying your own wise reflection is important. And so if you come across some teachings and it seems to make sense, also part of it is that it doesn't just say things that fit our opinions and our desires, but there's elements in there that challenge our own habits and self-centered ways of thinking. And so that it's not just gratifying our own views out of, saying, I like this, this agrees with me. But there's a kind of challenge and a drawing upon an intuitive sense of, well, whew, that's demanding, but somehow that feels like it's a good direction to go. And there's a beautiful set of teachings that the Buddha gave as advice to his foster mother, who became who was his aunt, who became his sort of his surrogate mother when he was growing up, and she was the first nun, Mahapajapati Gotami, and these eight pieces of advice that he gave her, which she said, how do you know what is the good Dhamma, what is not the good Dhamma? And that's a really excellent collection. I cannot recite them off the top of my head. But Ajahn Pasano is reaching for his phone.
Well, that's the one thing I can do.
Yeah, eight.
Because I can't recite the Wabda Dhamma here, but I'm surprised.
The eight pieces of advice to go to me. And it's a kind of a very practical set of measures, things that incline towards simplicity rather than complication, towards relinquishment rather than accumulation. So it's very tangible, and it's a sort of eight criteria that you can sort of bear in mind and say, well, this teaching is impressive, or it's powerful, or it's poetic, or appealing. Does it meet these criteria? So that's a handy measure. The Book of the Eights.
Yeah, Book of the Eights, Sutta number 53. so that those qualities that lead to... Yeah, you can look at it. And it might be handy to have the alternate translation. Because I've got Ajahn Jeff's here, so there's some. That's oftentimes a good way of getting a good feel for the terminology. So those qualities leading to dispassion, not to passion, to being unfettered, not to being fettered, to shedding, not to accumulating, to modesty, not to self-aggrandizement, to contentment, not to discontent, to seclusion, not to entanglement, to arouse persistence, not to laziness, to being unburdensome, not to being burdensome. If you have these, you may categorically hold, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the teacher's instruction.
It's very, very, very close.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sutta 53 in the Book of the Eights.
Yeah.
If I could just mention something, I think something else about this sutta is that he said Dhamma Vinaya. It wasn't just Dhamma. Wasn't that a part of that?
I think that's what you read.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, I mean, the Buddha always describes his teaching as a Dhamma Vinaya, both this teaching and this training. It's not this teaching and these bunch of rules. It's this Vinaya as a training, so that when the Buddha referred to his own dispensation, he called it this Dhamma Vinaya, as opposed to this standalone teaching, because it's a teaching and a training.
He said, this is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the teaching of the teacher. Yeah, it's a very short sutta. It's only half a page. But it's a very handy set of things to bear in mind.
See, Abhidhamma, it has a name, is it her collection of the Abhidhamma texts?
Abhidhamma?
That's a completely separate...
The philosophy section, as opposed to the sutras.
Well, the Abhidhamma is more like a sort of systematic... categorization of qualities.
It's a whole set of teachings on its own.
Right. Yeah. Is it a collection that's kind of standard from a Theravada perspective?
Oh, it's like seven books of Abhidhamma in the Theravada anyway.
There's a couple of books. I think Nina van Gorkum wrote one called something like Abhidhamma in daily life.
Abhidhamma in daily life, yeah.
And I think Bhikkhu Bodhi also did sort of a similar thing, you know, because it's pretty dry reading. The suttas and the Vinaya are not exactly page turners a lot of the time, but the Abhidhamma is like reading a telephone book. So people like Bhikkhu Bodhi and Nina van Gorkum, I think they've done a good job trying to put it into tangible, relatable terms. Yeah, this one is and it's also it's kind of touching that it's the Mahaprajapati, who was the first nun and who was his mother for most of his childhood, so asking for advice. This is the advice he's giving her as a sort of framework for understanding what is the teaching, what is the training. Because a number of the elements are to do with lifestyle and and the way you relate to material resources and such like. Because, you know, she was a queen before she was a nun. So, you know, she came from a luxurious lifestyle. So things like leading to solitude, not to being in company, leading to being easy to support, not difficult to support. You know, if you've been a queen, you're rather used to having large supplies of everything that might be convenient and delightful. But it's inclining towards being easy to support and being having fewness of needs, essentially.
Yes, sure.
It's just wondering about the heaven aspect that you referred to.
The heavens.
Huh?
Wondering about the heavens.
Yes.
The
heaven, yes.
And you also talked about that a couple of days ago.
Yes.
As being one of, you know, if you practice Dana and Sila, then you experience the sort of, the heaven, you think you refer to it as being like the sort of almost heavenly states of mind, because it
means, yeah.
Just then, you kind of refer to it. I mean, I'm confused, so that's why I'm asking, as what it means, because you said something about it being awareness of other realms, heavenly realms, and that the seeker
needs. Yep.
So it's experiencing, you know, whatever the results of leading a good life and being generous.
Yep.
As a kind of could be, but also heavenly realms, implying that they're other realms.
There are other realms.
What does it mean in that sense? What is this heaven thing? Because heaven is such a Christian concept as well, isn't it?
No, it's a Buddhist concept.
Well, it can be confusing that you think of heaven. What is heaven?
Well, I mean, in Buddhist cosmology, then you've got a whole range of different heavenly realms. I mean, we do, like when we chant the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, then you start, you know, starting right, you know, the
Bhumadeva, Chatumaharajikas, Tavatiksa, Yama.
Yes, all these those are all heavenly realms, different existences that have different characteristics.
But is the implication that you can't progress further on the path to enlightenment unless you've had realization that there is
a... No, I don't think I don't think that that's the case at all. I think what the Buddha is doing is laying a foundation for whatever is going to prepare the mind to be ready, pliable, free from hindrances. And so that's part of his toolkit for doing that. It's a graduated teaching. So it gives one, I think, is especially if you're already within a context of, say, culturally, that it's quite ordinary to think about it, then it encourages one. In a context of, say, even from a sort of a Western materialist sense, recognizing that there are heavenly states of mind, even in the present moment, that are accessible when you develop some refinement of consciousness. You're not just stuck in kind of, again, sort of trying to lay the foundation for the breakthrough to stream entry by being miserable and depressed. I mean, it's just not going to work.
But it might, though. Right? I mean, if it's...
I'm not sure in which realm.
I mean, if you're seeing it as suffering, if you may be depressed and then you have the realization that it's not what you are and that it is...
Yeah, and then if you see that it's not what you are, then you start seeing that there's possibilities of refinement of consciousness.
I'm not the only one struggling with this idea of heaven as being part of the path.
I'm just saying what the Buddha said.
I mean, I'm trying to understand it and how it would apply.
It's also a curious word, sagga. And it's I'm not sure where it's elsewhere that it's used. The word is saga.
There's also I feel that there's the heavenly mind states, so that some of the great enlightened elders like Sariputta had no psychic powers whatsoever. He couldn't see into the heaven realms, but he was an absolutely brilliant meditator. And the Buddha praised Sariputta. He said, just like a rich merchant has got trunks full of clothes and a merchant can choose what clothes they wear in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, and just put on whatever they want to wear during the course of a day, Sariputta can put on any kind of mind state. He can absorb his mind in any kind of state of concentration just by directing his attention. And so extraordinarily adept at meditation. And thereby, by bright, wholesome, sort of, and radiant states of mind, but had no ability to see into the different heavenly realms. And that another of the great elders, like Anuruddha, he had those abilities even before his enlightenment. And so he could see into different dimensions of being, but he wasn't yet liberated. And there's this exchange. One of the earlier readings where Sariputta is kind of putting him on the right track, because Anuruddha is saying, "I can see into all these different realms of existence, but you know, why am I not liberated yet?" So there's the kind of heavenly states of bright states of mind that are wholesome and spacious and can be experienced here and now, you know, with the human body and so forth, and then the different dimensions of being. The list that Lumbhor Pasanna was talking about, and we recited in the Dhammacakka Sutta like we did last night.
Yes.
Yesterday evening. So the earth spirits, the heaven of the four great the local palas, then the 33 gods and the Yama Devas, the Tusita Devas, and so on and so forth, and all the Brahma worlds. So there's two different meanings. There's the kind of heavenly mind states that are part of the kind of everyday experience based on clarity of meditation and concentration in particular. And then there are these different dimensions of existence. And so that when the words... when he's talking about the heavens in that context of the Anupupikata, the graduated teaching, it's like recognizing it. If you live in a wholesome way, if you live in a way that's unselfish and generous, compassionate, harmless, honest, and so forth, then you're creating the conditions whereby those heavenly mind states can be experienced, and at the death of the body, it's likely to be a condition for reappearing in one of those bright, wholesome realms. But I wouldn't say that heaven is, those heavenly realms are necessarily part of the path, but those wholesome mind states definitely are, that we can experience everyday life.
Yeah, and you can experience the fruits of that. Because I looked up the word sakha, and there's two translations. One is heavenly, the other one is heaven, comma, paradise sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either both the causal condition as well as the resultant condition.
Then talking about depression and dark mind states, there's another very significant teaching of the Buddha is, I think it's in the numerical discourses in the Book of the Sixes. It's the Book of the Fours, where he says, anyway, he says, dukkha ripens in one of two ways, either in more dukkha or in search, so that it's a cause for investigation. And so that if there is, the mind is dominated by ignorance, then suffering just leads to creating causes for more suffering. I'm uncomfortable, this is painful, I want to get out of here, I want to do something different, I need a distraction, I just want to eat something or go somewhere or something, anything, to get away from this. So that creates more dukkha. Or he says, but then when he defines search, he says, search is that sense of, this can't be the only possibility. There has to be a way out of it. Now, what is the way out of this? And that's the arising of faith. That sense of, this can't be the whole story. There's got to be a way out of this. Now, what is the way? So that's the beginning of sadha. So that dukkha leads to that quality of sadha, which is a bright, spacious quality. So painful mind states can be a cause for that brightening, but as long as the mind is locked onto the dukkha and identified with it, then it's not going to lead to liberation. It's that search element, that wise reflection that comes in and says, there are people who don't experience this or who are not locked into this, or that there has to be a way out of this. There has to be an alternative. Now, what is that? Like,
surely there must be a way out of
this. Yes, surely there must be a way out of this.
Robin, you had your hand up many times.
I've come across the word celestial state, heavenly state.
Yeah.
Does that help to clarify the Christian definition of heaven versus like the? I mean, I've seen this in text.
But I think it's just another word that is, you know, it's like a. Similar meaning.
It's more that has more to do with the sky.
Yeah,
like ciel is the French word for sky, so it just means kind of up there.
Kind of up there.
But I would say the Christian. Well, it depends which Christian you talk to. but the general concept of heaven as where you go to when you die if you've been good and you get to be with God and Jesus and Mary forever is very, very different. Heavenly model than what you have in the Buddhist cosmology, because you've got it's not a sort of go to heaven forever or not in the Buddhist world. Those domains of being are just places of rebirth, planes of birth where a being can live a life for a certain amount of time and then that life comes to an end, they can be born anywhere else.
Yeah, part of that, snakes and ladders.
Snakes and ladders, yes.
From what you're saying, it sounds like one way of looking at it is the Buddha's just trying to prepare the mind for someone to be receptive to the Four Noble Truths.
Yes.
And the thing about the heaven is a way of uplifting the mind. It is possible to experience a blissful mind or a mind that's free of dukkha or a mind that's at ease.
Yeah.
So whether it's a realm or a state of mind, is this a tool of uplifting?
Yeah.
Is that one way of...
Yeah, and I would personally. That's how I would take it. More that it's part of his toolkit to help to lay a foundation so that the mind is ready and pliable to be able to take in the Four Noble Truths and penetrate them.
Yeah, I think the languaging of it is, isn't it? It's the advantages of heaven.
It's not. Which is maybe in some translations, but I think as a literal translation, it's a standalone. Just throw it out there, one word, sangha.
Because I think it's also part of it is introducing people to the idea of cause and effect, and the beneficial results of wholesome action lead to bright mind states or bright, pleasant place of rebirth. So that there is just the cause. If the cause is wholesome, unselfish, noble, beautiful, then it leads to beneficial, pleasant results. So it's a kind of an entry point into thinking in terms of causality.
Another thing is looking at this gradual teaching as the Buddha teaching a variety of people. There are some people who faith types, who can do generosity, virtue, and the concept of heaven is going to encourage them. As soon as you get to renunciation, they won't do it. And so those three together can be a rather potent force for goodness, even when renunciation is just out of the picture.
Yeah, and as I say, it is a graduated kind of graduated teaching, so that bit by bit, sort of whatever works. Okay, any more questions? Okay, we'll continue on. So the third factor for stream entry is careful attention, yoniso manasikara. This term can be translated in many ways: wise consideration, skillful reflection, clear thinking, appropriate attention, keen application of mind. I mean, there's many ways. Interesting term to try to capture it in translation. The sort of manasikara is like attention in terms of the direct translation, and yoniso is like going to the root of things, yoni is the womb, so going to the source, going to the root. Appropriate attention, clear thinking, wise consideration are all translations. Applying the mind as skillfully as possible. The importance of this element in the development of the qualities useful for understanding and penetrating truth cannot be underestimated. So the next quote is from Samyutta 45, Sutta number 55, and that Samyutta 45 is from the Magga Samyutta on the collection on the path. Because this is the forerunner and precursor of the rising of the sun, that is, the dawn. So too, bhikkhus, for a bhikkhu, this is the forerunner and precursor for the arising of the Noble Eightfold Path, that is, accomplishment in careful attention. When a bhikkhu is accomplished in careful attention, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate this Noble Eightfold Path. So then, it's a very simple statement, but quite powerful. It's that sense of the role of applying the mind skillfully to what's in front of it. And the next quote that I have is from Majjhima 2, which is the Sabbasava Sutta, which we read some time ago. I'm sure everybody will remember it. Because I say that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. Who knows and sees what? Wise attention and unwise attention. When one attends unwisely, unarisen taints arise and arisen taints increase. When one attends wisely, unarisen taints do not arise, and arisen taints are abandoned. Bhikkhus, a well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, who has regard for true beings and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he does not attend to those things unfit for attention, and he attends to those things fit for attention. what are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire arises in him, and the arisen taint of sensual desire increases. The unarisen taint of being, or bhava-asava, these are the asavas, the taints. The unarisen taint of being arises in him, and the arisen taint of being increases. The unarisen taint of ignorance arises in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance increases. These are the things unfit for attention that he does not attend to. And what are the things fit for attention that he attends to? They are things such that when he attends to them, the unarisen taint of sensual desire does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of sensual desire is abandoned. The unarisen taint of being does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of being is abandoned. The unarisen taint of ignorance does not arise in him, and the arisen taint of ignorance is abandoned. He attends wisely. This is suffering. He attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. He attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When he attends wisely in this way, three fetters are abandoned in him: personality view, doubt, and adherence to rules and observances. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by seeing. Of course, what that's saying, that seeing with wise attention these the Four Noble Truths, it leads to stream entry, the relinquishing of those fetters of Sakaya Ditti, Vichikicca, and Sila Bhatta Paramasa. Next one is there any questions before that? Yeah.
Question about Yonisomanasikara and Sampisampajanya.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe how would you kind of
how are they the same and how are they different?
Yeah, maybe using them and yeah.
But I would, yeah, I mean, certainly the similarity is the sense of clarity. Sati Sampajanya is mindfulness, clear comprehension, is certainly the an application of attention and awareness, so that there's a continuity of clarity. In my mind, the yoniso manasikara, this wise attention, can be quite similar to sati sampajanya, but there's a certain, maybe the distinguishing characteristic of it is maybe that questioning or reflective sense. Although there's no reason why sati sampajanya can't be reflective. So there's a lot. I would say there's a lot of overlap, and to draw a clear distinction between the two of them would be very, very difficult. I don't know how one would do that.
Would it be kind of like Yoniso Manasikara could have more of like a transcending quality from like getting to the root attention, and kind of.
Well, yes and no. I mean, even you think of the Satipatthana Sutta, because each of the bases of the Satipatthana have the potential of liberation as well. And so that, and that whole section on sati sampajanya concerned with the body has that potential.
They're also, and the two of those are side by side in this, the sutta I was talking about, the origin of ignorance, the Avijja Sutta. So this is Sutta 61 in the Book of the Tens, where it says, what is the nutriment what is the nutriment for non-restraint of the sense faculties? So lack of sense restraint, it should be said, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. What is the nutriment for lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension? It should be said, careless attention. Careless attention too, I say, has a nutriment. It's not without a nutriment. What is the nutriment for careless attention? It should be said, lack of faith. So that there's two, and then in the reverse order, the support for sati sampajanya is yoniso manasikara in that particular teaching. So they're kind of next to each other, but yoniso manasikara is kind of taken as a nutriment or a support, something that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension. So it's heading in this recension, then sati sampajanya is a more sort of profound or wholesome, liberated quality. It's heading in that direction. But they are side by side, so one is a direct support for the other. But I think what you were saying also about and the point of kind of investigation, there's more of that kind of examining, comparing element for yoniso manasikara, kind of recognizing the patterns of things. And then that leads to sati sampajanya insofar as like having seen how things work together and having seen what's going on, then there's a much stronger sense of attunement of taking in the picture of what's happening here and now in a more complete and accurate, full way. But they're very close, and I would say they overlap a lot.
Yeah, they overlap a lot in there. So I wouldn't, it's hard to sort of, yeah, again, the boundaries of them are very, very hard to find.
It's also interesting in this sutta with respect to the four supports for stream entry. So the process starts off with, mindfulness and clear comprehension. Careful attention, I say, has a nutriment. It's not without nutriment. What is a nutriment for careful attention? It's faith. Faith has a nutriment, not without a nutriment. What is a nutriment? Hearing the good Dhamma. Hearing the good Dhamma has a nutriment, not without nutriment. What is a nutriment for hearing the good Dhamma? Association with good people. So, saparisa sangseva, sadhamma samana. And then that leads to faith. And then faith leads to yoniso manasikara, and that leads to sati sampajanya. So that those three of the four qualities are right there.
Yeah, or you could even sort of put, well, I mean, it's just extrapolating, but you put sati sampajanya into practicing Dhamma according to Dhamma.
And yeah, so that they're kind of those conditions supportive for stream entry are also the conditions supportive for dissolving ignorance and for helping liberation, true knowledge of and liberation to be actualized. Anyway, sutta number 61 in the Book of the Tens, the ignorance sutta.
The next sutta is from the Khanda Samyutta, Samyutta 22, Sutta number 122. Sorry, this is a question and answer session between Mahakotita and Sariputta, and these are They are, there's a lot of these exchanges in the Sutta Pitaka between these two monks, and Mahakutita is pretty good at getting Sariputta to explain things. Mahakutita asks, "Sariputta, my friend, which things should a virtuous monk attend to in an appropriate way?" Sariputta: "A virtuous monk, Kotita, my friend, should attend in an appropriate way to the five clinging aggregates as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a dissolution, an emptiness, not self. What five? Form as a clinging aggregate, feeling as a clinging aggregate, perception, formations, consciousness as a clinging aggregate. A virtuous monk should attend in an appropriate way to these five clinging aggregates as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a dissolution, emptiness, not self. For it is possible that a virtuous monk attending in an appropriate way to these five clinging aggregates in such a way would realize the fruit of stream entry." So it's contemplation of the five aggregates as anicca, dukkha, anatta in its various permutations is a catalyst or foundation for the realization of stream entry. I thought I would read the whole sutta. I mean, we're focused on this chapter is on stream entry, but the sutta is a bit, gives a bit more detail. I personally really like this sutta, and I quote it quite often. And the title of the sutta is Virtuous. So that was Ajahn Jeff's translation, and this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And of course, it repeats the beginning, and then it carries on after that. "On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahakutita were dwelling in at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then in the evening, the Venerable Mahakutita emerged from seclusion, approached the Venerable Sariputta, exchanged greetings, and said to him, 'Friend Sariputta, what are the things that a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to?' 'Friend Kotita, a virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. What five? The form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging, the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. A virtuous bhikkhu should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging, as impermanent, so on, as non-self. When, friend, a virtuous bhikkhu carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of stream entry. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer should carefully attend to? Friend Kotita, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as terminal." It goes through the whole thing again exactly the same way. "As non-self. When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a stream enterer carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of once returning. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a once returner should carefully attend to? Friend Kodita, a bhikkhu who is a once returner, should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as suffering, and so on, as non-self. When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a once returner carefully attends thus to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of non-returning. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is a non-returner should carefully attend to? Friend Kodita, a bhikkhu who is a non-returner should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging. And this goes all through the same thing, exactly the same way. When, friend, a bhikkhu who is a non-returner carefully attends to these five aggregates subject to clinging, it is possible that he may realize the fruit of arahantship. But, friend Sariputta, what are the things that a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to? Friend Kodita, a bhikkhu who is an arahant should carefully attend to these five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, as misery, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as empty, as non-self. For the arahant, friend, there is nothing further that has to be done and no repetition of what he has already done. However, when these things are developed and cultivated, they lead to a pleasant dwelling in this very life and to mindfulness and clear comprehension. There's that sati sampajanya again. So even an arahant is using that wise reflection to facilitate or support the continuity of clarity and sati sampajanya.
I have a question regarding the how to approach the different states we're going through with our observation. So sometimes we have some desires and then sometimes they're not fulfilled. So there's some craving and then aversion. Then sometimes it's stabilized and sometimes it fluctuates back again. I wonder if you have any advice of how when we kind of get stuck in aversion,
mm-hmm.
and we're not able to see the maybe the anatta aspect. Yeah, and then
yeah. I think whichever angle you can come from it, like that anicca dukkha anatta are not, again, they're just sort of characteristics of all phenomena. And so that just seeing their impermanent, changing, unstable nature is sometimes enough. Sometimes seeing the discomfort, discontent that arises, seeing the dukkha aspect is enough to sort of click it. And or seeing the insubstantiality, it's not possible to say this identify with this is truly me, this is truly mine, this is what I am. So seeing the not self aspect, at sort of whatever angle, sort of you there's some interest to look from or some feeling of relevance, then that works.
Wise to use memory in these moments when we feel kind of stuck?
Or anything that works. No, I mean, you want to draw on your resources. That's a really skillful use of memory. Rather than, you know, going, there's this sort of reminiscing with longing or regret, sort of using memory to, I've seen this, I've done that, been there, done that. This is getting boring. So there's a memory of what one has experienced, and it's And you can use memory to say, I've let go of this before. I've seen through this before. This hasn't satisfied before. And it really encourages one. So, yeah, you want to encourage oneself to use that memory, which I think is a really useful application of wise attention, that yoni so manasikara, skillful reflection.
So when we sometimes feel overwhelmed, like the defilement seems stronger than us, we try to apply the wise attention, and somehow it's not strong enough compared to the force of the defilement. So is it okay to use force, like to... Or is it like creating a sort of a version?
Well, I mean, I think one of the, there's a really good sutta, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, where the Buddha is giving techniques for dealing with thought, you know, the thoughts that come up in the mind.
Which sutta?
Sutta 21, the Majjhima. 19, 20, 21.
Yeah, I think it's, yes, correct. I think it's 20.
It's 20.
Yeah, 20.
Majjhima 20. So that the Buddha gives five different ways of dealing with it. One is just sort of seeing, replacing, calming and settling, disregarding. Distracting, you know, diverting one's attention, and then the very last one is force, and it's sort of like when nothing else works, you might want to try that. It's not high on the list of skillful options, you know, even by the Buddha's own sort of lists.
This sutta is about the tense.
It's called the removal of distracted thought. So I think it's sutta number 20. I think it is. The 18 is the one about conceptual proliferation, the honey ball sutta. And I think there's three of them altogether that are about very useful meditation teachings. And so I think the Vitakka Santana Sutta, that's
20. Sutta no Majjhima 20. Yeah, 18 is a honeyball sutta, excellent sutta in terms of dealing with thought proliferation. 19 is the two sorts of thinking. So those three are all really excellent suttas in terms of dealing with the thoughts in the mind. The thinking mind.
Yeah, in that regard, how to deal with fear when you're in a... Can I still ask a question, or you want to finish?
We're getting pretty close to wrapping up. Actually passed, yes?
So... in regard to the question before, like when you're out of it, then
when you're
out of the suffering, like
when yes.
it passes, right?
Yeah.
So then I notice there's like this fear of it happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And, how to deal with
it? Well, I mean, it's a separate. I mean, what you that's where the reflecting on one's successes are really helpful. Like actually turn, because you know the mind tends to be, we dwell on our failures, and you know, to actually really give positive attention to the things that did work, the things that really helped, the thing, you know, really consciously directing attention. It's really important. And we have a fundamental resistance to doing that. Mine goes to the disaster scenarios pretty quickly. So it's just really conscious, which is another application of that wise attention, you know, attending to what worked, what was skillful, what was really beneficial.
It reminds me many years ago when one of the first community retreats at Chidhurst, I think Lumpur Samhita could detect a certain kind of grim seriousness in the room. We'd been on retreat together for about a week, and this was way back in the early days of Chidhurst, so what's now the reception room was our shrine room. And he said, "We've been on this retreat together for a week, and nobody has killed anybody else. This is great. Well done. Well done. And you've all been celibate. That's amazing. A house full of men and women together, and no one's had sex with anybody else. Incredible. Wonderful. Well done. Well done. This is amazing. This is rare in the world that people are so patient, so kind, so restrained." And you could feel it sort of like, right, wow, yes. There's sort of like all these little moles coming out of our mole holes, you know, around the... Oh my goodness, that's quite a thought. Yeah, we haven't killed anybody. And they're just looking on the what we have done rather than dwelling on the negative side, the glass half full, the glass half empty dynamic. And so I think Lumpur's point is very, very pertinent that even when you think that, you know, there's some difficult issue has it might come back and say, well, it was tough working with that, but at least I didn't act on it and kill anybody. Yeah, that angry feeling, or I didn't run away, I didn't go and get drunk. Well, great. Well, good job me. You know, and that there's a recognition of the qualities of patience and restraint and unselfishness that have been developed. So, important part of the picture. Time to finish.